Justice Ian Walsh Bradley, were you good? Very good. I wanted to be sure you were going to join us visually. Okay, so we have the court present and the four lawyers who will argue the case for us today. We'll be starting out with Attorney Essenberg for 15 minutes, then Attorney Teslin for 15 minutes, Attorney Boylan for 5 minutes, Attorney Bitar for 45 minutes, and in rebuttal, Attorney Essenberg for 5 minutes, and Attorney Teslin for 5 minutes. Does that match your schedule, counsel? Okay, very good. I will then call our case for the morning. Oh my, we have three cases, of course, so let me just see what kind of a full listing we have of them here. We have James versus Heinrich, WCRIS versus Heinrich, and St. Ambrose Academy versus Parisi. Counsel Essenberg, are you prepared to begin?
I am, Your Honor. Thank you.
Please do.
Good morning, may it please the court. For the petitioners in the consolidated cases, I will be addressing the issue of whether or not the respondents had the statutory authority to issue the challenged order. My friend, Mr. Sellin, will be addressing the constitutional issues and whether, if the order were authorized, it is reasonably necessary within the meaning of the statute. And my friend, Mr. Boyland, will be wrapping up. This court has enjoined the challenged order closing petitioners' religious private schools on standard statutory grounds using customary principles of interpretation and construction. Section 252 is a comprehensive allocation of authority to the Department of Health Services and local health officials regarding the control of communicable diseases. In statutory terms, it is the unius that should be evaluated by this court to determine who may do what. No one claims that either the Department of Health Services or local health officials are provided with direct statutory authority to do anything with respect to the control of communicable diseases other than as set forth in Chapter 252. Now, both statutes include language which grants broad authority to DHS and local health officials. Both are told that they may do what is necessary to control communicable diseases. But at the same time, both DHS and local health officials are also provided with specific direction as to what they may do. DHS.
Attorney Essenberg, let's talk about the statute and the language and the specific direction. So looking at 252.03 sub 1, if we look at the language, and you said customary statutory interpretation, which is exactly what we should be doing, that language, every local health officer, upon the appearance of any communicable disease, shall immediately investigate and make a full report. The local health officer shall promptly take all measures necessary to prevent, suppress, and control communicable diseases. So that is the language. But you want us to read that language to say, but may not close public buildings and grounds if those public buildings and grounds happen to be schools. So where in the statute does the extra piece that I just added, where do you find that? And why wouldn't we give every customary statutory interpretation to this very broad grant of authority?
Well, with respect, that is not the only language that we have to look at in construing Chapter 252. If it were, then we might proceed to the constitutional issues that my friend Mr. Sellin will address, and also the constitutional issues regarding the non-delegation of authority and some of the questions that were addressed by the Chief Justice's opinion in Palm, where she made clear that broad language like that cannot be read to confer unlimited police power on a single executive official. But in this case, we have additional statutory language. We have specific grants of statutory authority to both DHS and local public health officials, suggesting that this broad description of authority is limited by those specific grants. That is, in terms of our phrasing of principles of statutory construction, the specific control is the general. And here, with respect to DHS, DHS is told by the legislature that it may forbid public gatherings and it may close schools. Local health officials are only told that they may forbid public health gatherings.
Mr. Essenberg, let me stop you there, because I think a lot of in your brief, the brief that you and Mr. Testlin submitted, talks a lot about closing schools. And you've talked a lot already today about closing schools. I'm looking at the order that was issued September 1st, 2020, by the Dane County Health Official. I'm looking at Section 4D, which is the section that we are talking about today. Please show me where in this section the phrase closed schools exists.
Well, the order forbids in-person instruction, and this issue was addressed by the court in its order on the motion for temporary injunction. And this court noted, a majority said, that the statute was written in 1923. Virtual instruction certainly was not a possibility then. And it makes sense to read this as addressing the question of whether or not instruction is being offered in person in the classroom.
Again, Mr. Essenberg, I'm really taken aback by the fact that you are going to read something into the statutes after the number of submissions I've seen you make to this court where you talk about a strict reading of the statutes, a strict reading of this rule, and this rule does not talk about closing schools. These schools, in fact, are open. All schools are open. Teachers are allowed to have access to them. That's what this rule said. I realize that there's an injunction, but were the injunction not there, no school was ordered to be closed.
Well, I think that is, as a majority of this court concluded in passing on the motion for a temporary injunction and concluding that it was likely to succeed, that is an originalist reading of the statute.
So what you are relying on, just so I understand, that what you are relying on is this court's decision to grant the injunction as the authority going forward for us then to follow your argument.
Well, I'm relying on the reasoning that was set forth in this court's grant of the preliminary injunction. The court looked at the statute and says, does it make sense to read offering virtual instruction, which is not in the school, right? I mean, it takes place over the internet. Does it make sense to say that school is open within the meaning of the statute that was written in 1923? And the court concluded that it was not. That makes perfect sense given what we know about the distinction between in-person and virtual instruction. But the significant point here is that the court addressed this issue and concluded that this was the most reasonable reading of the statute, that it is one that comports with the original meaning of the phrase in the statute, and that virtually no one would conclude that a school that is shut down, that students may not enter, may not interact with their fellow students, may not interact in person with their teachers, is a school that's closed. And so I understand why this court had little difficulty concluding on a I don't like to use the word strict construction, but on a textualist and originalist basis that the statute applies here, because in effect, what has happened here is that these schools have been closed to instruction from the third to 12th grade.
Attorney Essenberg, but getting back to that strict constructionist, if you look at this language, and I've already outlined the very broad grant of authority that somehow you're reading in an exception. But in addition to that, if you look at what it's talking about here, it's talking about buildings. It's talking about physical spaces. And so what you're then reading into this is somehow beyond that. Have you ever observed online school? People are interacting. Children are interacting with each other. They're interacting with their teacher. What they're not doing is being physically together in a public building, which is exactly, in a strict constructionist manner, looks to be what the duties of local health officers are in terms of buildings. And it's exactly what Justice Klosky read regarding the order that's in effect here. So when you talk about strict constructionalists, I still fail to see how you get that out of this particular provision in 252.03, sub 1 and sub 2.
Well, I mean, again, the term I would use is not so much strict construction, but appropriate construction, given the plain meaning of the text and its original understanding. And here, if in fact, as Your Honor suggests, the statute refers to the closure of physical buildings have been closed here. That is, the predicate for Section 252 has been satisfied. And once again, I am not asking you to read something into the general grant of authority that is not there. What I am urging the court to do is to read the entire statute. And when we read the entire statute, including the more specific grant of authority and the quite critical conferral of the power to close schools on DHS and the quite conspicuous failure to confer that authority on local health officials, then by common principles, long accepted principles of statutory construction, expresso unius, the doctrine that the specific controls the general, the canon against constitutional doubt, because as the decision in Palm points out, to read this as a general conferral of police power on an unelected official to do whatever is necessary would create grave constitutional concerns. When we consider those canons of constitutional interpretation, then I think it becomes clear, as this court concluded in determining the petitioners have a reasonable likelihood of success, that what has happened here when local officials have said that these private religious schools may not be open for students in grades 3
through 12. Mr. Essenberg, I'm going to stop you again because I think the words are important. And you keep talking about the private religious schools, and it's not. It's every school in Dane County. There was not a single school. There was not a single group of schools that was singled out. And so I'm going to take issue with the way that you have characterized what this order says. I have the order in front of me. The first word, the very first word in this section of the order, it says schools, period. The next word is public. Well, let me ask the question though. Let's take your reasoning to its logical conclusion, okay? If I understand your reasoning, the way that you are reading 252.03 is that this statute allows for a public official to close a school for, say, a local official, to close a school for, say, an unsanitary kitchen or a locker room that is not clean, but not for something like COVID-19.
Well, it allows the government to close schools with respect to something like COVID-19, because this statute does not prohibit school closures. It simply addresses who may close them. And in this instance, when we're dealing with a particular public health problem where a school may be closed for a limited period of time, yes, a local health official may have the authority to do that. But I think the legislature has made clear that when we're talking about a generalized closure of schools, a prophylactic prohibition of in-person instruction to reduce human contact to prevent the spread of communicable diseases, if that extraordinary thing is going to be done, then that must be done by the Department of Health Services. That must be done by a cabinet-level official. Now, to be sure, they can do that based upon information that they receive from local health officials. They can do that based on the recommendation of local health officials. But when it comes to an extraordinary step like that, when we're doing something like prohibiting a normal and lawful activity for an indefinite period of time, that's something that requires action and approval by a higher public official. And so the legislature made clear that when we're talking about those type of things, when we're talking about forbidding public gatherings, when we're talking about closing public schools, that specific authorization is required. Local health officials can do the former. They may not do the latter because the legislature has declined to give them that authority. Local health officials may be, as they like to say, the boots on the ground, but in this instance, the boots on the ground need to receive orders from above.
Justice Ann Walsh Bradley, I see you have a question pending.
Yes, thank you. Let's see if we can have...
Thank you. Justice Ann Walsh Bradley, you didn't get a chance to ask your question. I assume you're having some kind of technical problems.
I am, but I think I've got it straightened out, if I may.
Yes, please.
Let's see if this is an appropriate, or what is, as you refer to, counsel, as an appropriate construction. And that is, in pages 7, I think, to 10 in the DPI brief, they set forth several statutes that give specific authority for local health officials to close schools. How do those statutes, I guess I'm speaking specifically of WSSTAT 115.79.15.8M, or another good example is 115.01.10, which defines school days as a school's days on which school is closed by order of a local health services. The former statute makes reference to public emergency. The program under this section is closed, again, by a local health officer. How do those statutes implicate your statutory construction under 252?
Well, and I'm glad you asked that question. And as we addressed in our brief, none of those statutes confer authority on anyone. Not a single one of them has the language of conferral of power. They don't authorize anything. At most, they simply assume or recognize that local health officials might be able to close schools under some circumstances and then excuse schools from some consequence that might otherwise follow because of that, or in some cases actually treat those days as school days for purposes of meeting statutory requirements. And as we pointed out in our brief, there are certainly instances in which a local health official may issue an order that closes a school. They may be abating a human health hazard. They may be addressing problems other than communicable diseases. They may be acting at the direction of DHS, since DHS does have the authority to direct them to close schools, either under 252.02 or pursuant acting as an agent for the governor's emergency powers under 323.10. But those statutes do not confer authority on local health officials to do anything. They simply don't contain that language. And I think to regard them as a sub silentio amendment of 252.03 or a sub silentio authorization of such an extraordinary power would be a step too far.
Okay, thank you very much. Attorney Teslin, are you prepared to proceed?
Absolutely, thank you, Your Honor. As my friend Mr. Essenberg explained, I will be discussing why the school closure order is unconstitutional and unlawful because it doesn't satisfy the applicable strict scrutiny standard. But before I do that, just to close the loop on something that Justice Kurofsky was saying, at JA 98, Statement of Undisputed Fact 168, my friends conceded that the order here closes schools. But in any event, turning back to the applicable strict scrutiny standard, we think it is very important for this court to address the constitutional implications of the school closure order in order to provide full guidance to the public as part of this original action. Now, the school closure order is subject to strict scrutiny because it burdens our sincerely held religious beliefs under the state conscious causes. The school closure order does this by indefinitely taking away in-person communal religious instruction. The Statement of Undisputed Facts makes clear that communal religious education is core to our religious exercise. The Statement of Undisputed Facts makes clear that part of our religious exercise is the students engaging in frequent communal prayer throughout the day, communal adoration of the Eucharist. The religious mission thus depends on in-person attendance to be fully realized. These are all direct quotes from the Statement of Undisputed Fact. Now, my friend's primary argument on the other side is not to grapple with the burden on our religious exercise, but is to ask this court to invoke the wrong body of law. My friend, over and again, in his brief on the other side, cites the federal case Employment Division Services versus Smith. Under that federal rule, under the First Amendment, if you have a facially neutral statute and it happens to burden religious exercise, there is only rational basis. And my friend's logic is that, as Justice Kurofsky pointed out, because this order is facially neutral with regard to religious schools and non-religious schools, any burden on our sincere religious exercise is legally irrelevant. But this court in Miller explicitly, unambiguously rejected the Smith rule, and it confirmed that approach in Cooley. And it did so in Miller in striking down a facially neutral law that happened to burden Amish religious practice. And again, this was
Mr. Salen, I want to go back to this school closure, because the point, if I understood the point in your brief, is that Dane County, one of the points, is that Dane County is an outlier. And you are concerned about the calamitous effects that might take place for Dane County students if their schools were not open for in-person instruction. Am I understand? Do I have that part right?
Yes, we're concerned about us, about our schools, and with regard to this part of our argument, our religious exercise as part of in-person instruction. We have other arguments about all parents, about the right of parents to guide their education, but I'm here discussing the religious exercise.
Well, I understand that, but you pointed out that in the I think it was 168 of what was submitted as the joint agreement, the stipulation that you entered into, that the schools were closed. And I'm just trying to understand why this is so important regarding Dane County schools. And as I understand it, it was because Dane County was, back in September, was the only district or the county that did promulgate a rule like this to say that school was not going to be in person. If it was going to be 3-12, it was going to be online. But between that time and now, that's no longer the case, is it? There are many, many schools and many, many districts that have gone to online school. So I don't understand the argument that students in Dane County, and as a parent of a son in Dane County school who's been online, I'm actually really concerned about the impact that you assert in your brief that all of these kids are disadvantaged vis-a-vis the kids who are in person in class. Where does that come from?
With regard to what's happening across the state, Your Honor, while it's not in the record, my understanding is that only Racine County has also attempted to close private schools. And I could be wrong about that, but I believe it's just Dana and Racine. It is true that a lot of public schools have closed. You know, I think it's an unfortunate influence of some of the amici with regard to the teachers' unions that have created the situation where, unfortunately, a lot of students are falling further and further behind. But at least in those places outside of Dane County and maybe Racine, the local health officials have understood that it is important to allow private schools, if the parents so choose, to remain open, including religious private schools.
First of all, I think that the teachers have good reason to be concerned, since they are in the age group where the real negative impacts of COVID-19 could be severe, if not fatal. Having said that, where is this information that people like my son now is incredibly disadvantaged because he has been in school online? Where are you getting? I just don't see the basis for it. That is not in the stipulated facts.
That is correct.
You continue to assert it over and over again.
Well, with respect, Your Honor, the only time we assert with regard to the burden on the educational quality is the small portion of our brief that talks about parental rights. The lion's share of the argument that I'm presenting here in regard to constitutional claims is based on the burden on religious exercise. And with regard to that burden, we have, you know, paragraph after paragraph after paragraph in the statement of undisputed facts that our students – our schools are burdened in their religious exercise, in their ability
to... Let's talk about that, Attorney Seidman. Let's talk about the religious exercise in this specific order, because that's what we're here about. We're only here about an order that is relative to Dane County, and it is very detailed. And in 8 of that order, it talks about religious entities and groups organized and operated for a religious purpose, and they are exempted from this order and from the other provisions, including the part regarding schools, where they are, it is limited to, it includes mosques, synagogues, temples, religious studies. Religious entities are exempt from mass gathering requirements for religious services and religious practices. So how come this order, how come you assert that you are being somehow burdened in your religion when in fact, doesn't it look like you're getting extra accommodations so that you can, in fact, so that your schools can gather for purposes of religious studies?
I think it is undisputed between the parties in this case that this order applies to the religious schools here. If my friend on the other side were to get up and say that we read that exemption as not applying to the plaintiff schools, I would be quite surprised.
I don't think they're saying that because they're saying that the education, the secular learning piece is online, but doesn't this subsection allow you, if you were to say we need to gather to practice our religion, where in here are you not allowed to do that?
The statement of undisputed facts makes clear that religious practice is suffused with everything that happens in every one of our classes. There's communal prayer throughout the day at the beginning of every single class block. The actual religion, just like in this court's Cooley case, where this court discussed how the Catholic religion was suffused through everything the teacher taught, even when she was teaching math or social studies. That is exactly what's happening here. So our religious practice is suffused throughout everything we do, which is why throughout the day.
And can't that still be part of your online learning, and your gathering can then accommodate things like that need to be in person or that you want to be in person in terms of your religious practice? I mean, no one's saying that the teachers online are not able to continue to suffuse the learning throughout virtual education. Where is that in here? I don't see it.
But that's true that they can continue to suffuse the teaching of social studies or math religious instruction. But what cannot occur is the frequent communal prayer throughout the day, which is in the statement undisputed fact is part of our sincere religious exercise. Not all religious adherents believe that you need frequent communal prayer throughout the day, but we, the petitioners, or at least many of the petitioners, do in fact submit that.
Counsel, I wanted to ask a couple questions. Is the implication of your argument It would also mean that the statewide Department of Health Services would not have authority to close your school as well on constitutional grounds, the schools you're representing. Is that an accurate implication of the argument that you're making?
Our argument is that if the statewide DHS attempted to close schools, including our religious schools, that would be subject to strict scrutiny. That does not mean that they couldn't do it if they had a sufficiently tailored order that otherwise satisfied strict scrutiny. But we do believe that it would be subject to strict scrutiny under Miller and Cooley.
Yeah. The one interesting, I think, question in this case, I think you're right. Obviously, we've said strict scrutiny applies to these situations, and that's certainly correct. So it seems like the real question here is the nature of the sincerely held religious belief and sort of how that plays out. And, just want to offer a hypothetical, and maybe you can help me distinguish this, in some way. So suppose that, as part of the sincerely held religious belief, that you believe that serving the poor is part of your religious mission as a school. For example, and every week you go to visit the Salvation Army and, hand out toothpaste and soap and otherwise care for and minister to the poor. And then the state shut down the Salvation Army, thereby preventing that opportunity or other kinds of opportunities for in-person care for the poor. Would an order like that be subject to a similar kind of analysis? If not, help me work through that a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, I think that if they shut down one particular charitable outlet, and there were comparable ways to throughout the day or whatever the particular adherence to accomplish the same thing, I'm not
sure. Suppose there were not. Suppose that all of the homeless shelters are shut down in that way, and so the opportunity to have an in-person ministry to the poor is taken away due to, government shutdown efforts.
No, I think that if Your Honor creates the hypothetical that tightly, then I think Miller is directly on point. In this court in Miller, you had a facially neutral law that said everyone who has slow-moving vehicles got to have decals on the back. And this court said that the Amish, because of their similar religious belief, got strict scrutiny. I think, frankly, under my friend's citation of Employment Diversion Services versus Smith at the federal level, Miller would have come out the other way. They would have said it was a facially neutral law, and the law survives rational basis. And I think there's a reason that some people, including the late Justice Scalia, believed that the Smith standard was correct, because it does create some difficult hypotheticals. But this court read Smith and in Miller unambiguously rejected the Smith standard and reaffirmed that in Cooley. And again, I don't think that there's any gainsaying that it does create some difficult line drawing problems and some difficult results. But that is the cost that this court knowingly assumed when it adopted and retained its strict scrutiny approach in Miller, specifically rejecting Smith, even though the Supreme Court had just announced Smith not that long before. So since it's fairly clear, I think, as Justice Hagedorn's questions indicate, that strict scrutiny does apply under Miller and Cooley, the burden then shifts to my friends on the other side to show that they have satisfied strict scrutiny. And that's very important, that the burden is on them. And with regard to that, this court should look at the statement of undisputed fact, because that is the entire record that my friends on the other side agree to would be before the court. I would respectfully submit there is absolutely nothing in the statement of undisputed fact that comes close to satisfying the very heavy burden of strict scrutiny.
Counsel, mm-hmm. If the court resolves petitioner's claims in your favor on statutory grounds, is there a reason for us to address the constitutional claims that you're advancing?
I do think that there is reason. I think that this court takes cases in its original action jurisdiction to give guidance to the citizenry. For example, this court's decision in Palm, after opining on the procedural defects in the executive order there, this court then went on to talk about the substantive defects. I think it's quite important for this court to provide guidance on these important constitutional questions. It's been quite a little while since this court had Cooley and Miller before. It hasn't had the opportunity to really opine on the full implications of the strict scrutiny approach that this court has adopted, contrary to what the U.S. Supreme Court has done?
Are you also asking us to opine on the constitutional right of parents to control the details of their children's education?
I think Your Honors could do that, and Chief Justice, if I could
answer. Yeah, please finish the answer.
But we think that by far our more fully developed argument is the constitutional right with regard to the conscience clauses, so we would at least ask Your Honors to opine upon that. Thank you.
Very good. Thank you. Attorney Voiland, are you prepared to begin?
Yes, Chief Justice, I am.
Please do.
Good morning. May it please the court. On behalf of my client, Sarah James, I thank you for the opportunity to participate. And right away, I want to answer this question about where is this idea coming from that these students are disadvantaged? It's coming from Sarah James, my client. It's coming from their parents. If you look at the undisputed statement of facts, paragraph 5, Ms. James identifies how her children are disadvantaged by virtual learning. Paragraph 51, another parent identifies how their child is disadvantaged by virtual learning. Paragraph 55, another parent identifies how their child is disadvantaged by virtual learning. And then as you proceed through the undisputed statement of facts, that information is in there. Back to the religious practice issue, Ms. James also identifies in the undisputed statement of facts that virtual learning is not the practice of her faith or her children's faith. It needs to be in person because she believes that her children need to be in person with other children as part of the body of Christ. That is her belief. And switching to virtual education doesn't simply change the venue. It changes the entire education. It also, as Mr. Salen points out, the order closes schools. He pointed out—
Mr. Boylan, as long as you pointed out what is in the joint statement of facts regarding these parents' concern, tell me what in 55, it is the most general blanket description. How are we supposed to make a decision based on this? What this says is that this parent's child's education suffered in the spring and she'll continue to suffer.
Justice Karofsky, I appreciate it.
So look, you this brief repeats over and over again the same assertion that these kids are put at a disadvantage, that this health official, what she has done to these kids in Dane County is unforgivable. These kids are never going to be able to come back from the fact that they have been online school for this school year. You repeat it over and over again. And now you're telling me that it is based on an assertion by someone who says their child suffered in the spring and was continuing to suffer. Where is the proof? Where is the evidence of this? Do you have anything at all to back it up?
Thank you, Justice Karofsky, for that question. And you point to paragraph 55 that I pointed to, and you ask about that. You're correct that is a broad general statement. I'm answering this question in response to something that you brought up just minutes ago, and paragraph 5, 51, and 55 were the first ones that I got to. If I go to paragraph 5 on behalf of my client, the word is essential. Okay, for Ms. James and her children, it is essential that they are in person. And that is undisputed in the statement of facts. I don't think I can go further than that. And that is not as broad as paragraph 55. That is very specific, and essential is important. I want to go to something else that you asked about, Justice Karofsky, also about where are the schools closed. Mr. Salen pointed out 168. I'm pointing out paragraph 6 on behalf of my client. As a result of emergency order number 9, her children's school was closed.
Mr. Boylan, hold on. I hear you and I understand that they were afforded the opportunity for online schooling, were they not?
And online schooling is not an education, according to my client, Sarah James.
But we're talking about the phrase, are schools closed? Okay. And I really have a hard time understanding how a school is closed if teachers are still performing the educational functions online.
Okay, let me take a shot at that, if I may. And paragraph 6, again, says the school is closed as a result of emergency order number 9. When we go to the text of order number 9, paragraph 4D, it tells you that the schools are closed. It tells you what the schools may be open for, okay? In paragraph 4D of order number 9, it tells you what the schools can be open for. They may be open for food distribution, healthcare services, and child care and youth settings. And
Mr. Bowden, let me ask you the question this way. Let's do it this way. Imagine that we had an order that said there will be, may I finish asking this question, please, Chief Justice, and ask him to respond?
Yes, please, if you keep it brief.
Thank you. I appreciate it. What would it be? How would you describe it? What adjective would you use if schools did not allow online instruction, did not allow for child care, did not allow for the many things that are exceptions to this order? What would you call that?
What would I call that in the situation if schools didn't allow for child care or food distribution and so on, as you just added?
Yeah, or online instruction, yes.
I'd have to use a stronger word, such as that the schools were outlawed, possibly. And now they're closed. Under your scenario, they're outlawed.
Okay. Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Okay. Attorney Bitar, are you prepared to proceed?
I am prepared to proceed. Thank you, Chief
please
Justice.
Do.
And SAC, may it please the court. Ramzi Bitar, Municipal Law and Litigation Group, on behalf of the respondents. There is a place for religion in the public square, and it should be cherished and protected. But the rights of one person to exercise their religion in the public square, just like their rights to swing their arms in the public square, stop at another person's nose. The liberty secured by the Constitution does not import an absolute right to do all things at all times, in all circumstances, totally freed from restraint. There are manifold restraints to which every person is necessarily subjected for the common good. In this case, the local health officer tried to use great foresight to look ahead to where we might be with this epidemic. She knew that with the start of school, the cold weather setting in, everyone going into the school building at one time, all the teachers, all the students, all the staff, as the flu season roared up, that we would have the numbers that we are currently seeing right now. It was never a total school closure. It's ridiculous for them to even assert that. It was never directed at any of the religious schools whatsoever. It clearly carved out kindergarten, first grade, second grade. That is three grades going into school. Just before the court entered the injunction in this case, the next wave of kids were almost ready to go in. There was some flux in the viral numbers, but it was pointing towards entering those children into school. It was never a total closure, and to argue otherwise is ridiculous. I want to start with the statutory argument, since that's where the petitioners have begun this morning. And when we do statutory construction, we follow our typical rules. We are trying to plumb the meaning of a statute. We are not looking to use some kind of new formulated rules that the petitioners are applying in this case, that you need to look for magic words. What's the point of Kalal? What's the point of this court's decision in Milwaukee versus City of Milwaukee versus Washington, conducting statutory interpretation of the same chapter, if we're just looking for a magic word, whether it appears or not? That's not how we do statutory construction. We begin at 252.03. This is a broad mandate. The local health officer must take all measures necessary to prevent, suppress, and control a communicable disease. Where does this language come from? Where did it come from in 1923? Did it just drop out of thin air on the Capitol steps and they plugged it into a statute? No, it came from the common law at the time. Look at the case of Burge, cited in the petitioner's brief. from 1897. Look at Nowotny from 1904, cited in our briefing. Look at the Jacobson case. Irrespective from the constitutional analysis in Jacobson, look at the comments that Jacobson provided about how it is reasonable and necessary for local health officers to try to curb pandemics and disease. This is one of the biggest threats to mankind other than war.
Counsel, let's talk about Jacobson for just a minute here. I fail to see the relevance of Jacobson to this case at all. Jacobson involved a question, a functional, a rational basis type analysis, to use modern parlance, in terms of whether this was within the police powers of the state to force vaccination. But it didn't say anything about when those actions intersect with an enumerated fundamental constitutional right. So I'm not really sure how Jacobson has any relevance in this situation. If you could respond to that.
Sure, Justice Hagedorn. Jacobson, we have to step back and we have to look at what the petitioners haven't presented to you in the case law that they've cited. Religious rights have always been balanced with public health, welfare, and safety. Incidental burdens have been tolerated. Jacobson reflects that. What unites Jacobson and the Wisconsin Supreme Court decisions that came before Jacobson, came after, all the way up through Justice Scalia's decision in Smith, is the fact that the courts have recognized a certain degree of judicial humility towards neutral, general, non-discriminatory laws, except in the extreme cases. And when we look at Jacobson, Jacobson has not been overruled. And as the petitioners pointed out 2 weeks ago, we do have a per curiam decision from the Supreme Court. And it's interesting when you look at that decision, the standards or Jacobson is simply not discussed in the per curiam decision, because the nature of that health order was so anti-church and it directly went after the churches.
Just to push back a little bit, it is certainly the case that under our laws, religious practices cannot be treated as less than others, right? But I don't think it's the case that that's the maximum nature of the protection that it provides. I mean, our court has been quite clear that if you are burdening a sincerely held religious belief, that religion is preferred. Religious belief and practice is preferred to other actions. That is the clear teaching of our cases, that religion not is just to be treated the same, but is actually given special protection, where the people of the state of Wisconsin have said, you can tread no further. That's what we said in Miller. That's what we said in Cooley. I guess I'd like to hear any response you have to that. It's not just that religion is treated the same.
I don't think, Your Honor, that the courts went that far to say that an expression of your religious liberty is an absolute right to do all things at all times. If you look at Cooley, the court specifically said at paragraph 66, we are not exploring the outer boundaries. Further said, we do not mean to suggest that anything interfering with a religious organization is totally prohibited. That's paragraph 65. In the same paragraph, Cooley has said that general laws on all sorts of subjects are, quote, normally acceptable. The court also looked at a number of cases from the Fourth Circuit, and including, I believe, some citations to Smith in that case, that found that there can be instances where there can be some level of balancing. I don't think that this court, even under the petitioner's rules, they asked you to look at Cooley and then to go and look at Yoder and Sherbert and Prince and all these other cases. And when you look at all these other cases, they all speak in terms of challenged religious conduct, but it's not posing a substantial threat to the public health, safety, and welfare. So you can't reinvent all those cases. And to be clear, there's been some remarks in the petitioner's briefs that we're asking for a shift in the constitutional doctrine or for this court to somehow overrule Cooley. We're not asking for any of that. We're asking for the court to apply its case law that has existed for over 100 years that recognizes that there are times, such as what we're facing right now, where if you have this incidental burden, so long as a law is neutral and generally applicable, it can receive some deference. And we just saw that in the decision that we tried to send you yesterday, coming out of another state with the school closure type order, some phasing, and the court specifically found that order was general, it was neutral, and it was not subject to strict scrutiny. And that's what we would ask this court to follow right here. The same type
along
of
those lines, counsel, along those lines, can you address the exception that's made for religious entities and groups that seems to clearly allow for religious entities to gather for purposes of religious services and religious practices?
Yeah, between that carve out in emergency order number 9 for religious entities and groups, I would point out, and you read it earlier, I'm not going to read the language of it again, you all have it in front of you, but no other comparable group has a carve out like that. On top of that, when we look at the proposed facts, I would say that every proposed fact that they offered you so far today, there's caveats, both in terms of the impact on virtual learning, on development, as well as on their core religious beliefs. If you look at paragraphs 42, 62, 100, 81, and 164, they're all chock full with caveats about the extent of this burden on their religious rights. They can obtain their Christian education in other ways. Every single one of their religious lessons can be done online. They recognize that the phasing in of kindergarten, first grade, and second grade, as well as if the others had phased in right away, all of them would have been in school for the same day and the same type of activities. They recognize they can live out their religious missions. They can engage in daily prayer. They can go to mass. They can have confession. And so to say that there's a full knockout punch on religion between the facts and between this carve out is not true at all. And I think they're pushing this because they're trying to get the win that Jacobson never got. And they're trying to upset the case law that exists in this court for over 100 years just by proclaiming that they have some preference due to their religious beliefs to have education in school. We all know that case law isn't that plain. It's much more complicated than that. And they have not pointed you to the contours of that law. In terms of
I want to ask you to respond to something that Mr. Boylan pointed out, and it is 5 of the stipulated facts, and it concerns Miss James, who chose to enroll her children in religious school. It says because she sincerely believes it is essential that they receive a faith-based education. It goes on to say she believes that it is essential that her children's education take place in person, and together with others as part of the body of Christ. And so Mr. Boland's argument is that Miss James has these sincere beliefs, and she believes her children must be educated in school in order for her children's religious beliefs, for their family's religious beliefs, to be met. And tell me why that this order then doesn't violate the Wisconsin Constitution if she has, that this is what their family sincerely believes.
Because it has to be balanced against the common good for the society when we have a pandemic such as we're facing now. And even when we look at the case law that the petitioners want us to look at, such as Yoder and Sherbert and Prince, they all say that, for instance, Yoder, the challenged Amish religious practice in that case, quote, does not pose a substantial threat to public safety, peace, and order. And so while the petitioner you just referenced says I have this sincerely held religious belief, that may be true. But elsewhere in the stipulated facts, and I'm sorry, I don't have them in front of me right now, but there's caveats that reflect that the CDC, the American Academy of Pediatrics and other studies suggest that you can get by just fine with online virtual learning, especially in these times. And I think we have to balance that. And I think we should also bring out the concerns that the late Justice Scalia was trying to reflect in his decision in Smith. The reason for the general neutrality rules created in Smith was that Justice Scalia recognized that allowing believers to invoke religious exemption from any and all law makes them a law unto themselves. He was also concerned with judges having to get into the task of evaluating whether or not there is a truly sincerely held religious belief. Smith has never been overruled. Smith has been talked about, at least in some of our cases. This court really hasn't had an opportunity to address this kind of situation. Thank God it only comes around, you know, once every 100 years or 200 years. Let's hope it never comes back.
Counsel, just to follow up on Justice Kurofsky's question, I mean, we do have a test here that we have outlined and applied. And I guess I know you keep talking about sort of balancing against the common good, but that's not really a part of our test. The test is this a sincerely held religious belief? Is that belief burdened by the application of the law? And if so, then you would have the burden of proving this is a compelling state interest. I'll grant you that. But it cannot be served by a less restrictive alternative. So the balancing here is a pretty tall order, meaning strict scrutiny that you would have to do. It's not how do these rights play against each other? What makes the most sense? You've got the deck stacked against you. You've got to show that this is the only option we had and that this is the narrowest way for us to achieve our goals under the statute, providing the first two are met. So do you disagree that that's the test? Do you believe you satisfy strict scrutiny, or are you challenging that this is not a burdened, sincerely held religious belief?
I disagree that that's the test in this context, because we are looking at all of this court's decisions in common law. The plaintiffs are hanging their hat on Cooley as if Cooley had been a full exploration of this court's body of law. It was no such thing. And in fact, Cooley, with regard to strict scrutiny, said we have, quote, generally applied, close quote, strict scrutiny. And then the court went on to say that strict scrutiny, quote, is not helpful here, close quote. And when you look at a case that came after State versus Newman, involving the situation where the parents proclaimed that their Wisconsin Freedom of Conscience Clause rights gave them the right to not give their young daughter needed medical treatment leading to her death, this court looked at Smith, this court looked back at Sherbert, and found that the constitutional freedom of religion might be absolute as to belief, but not as to conduct, which may be regulated for the protection of society. So we do disagree with the approach that the petitioners are asking this court to take, because we have a general, neutral, applicable law. We have the situation before us where this health order is trying to protect the public health, safety, and welfare. A more nuanced approach needs to be taken. This does.
Let me ask you a question. I want to follow up on Justice Hagedorn's following up on my question. We're at about three levels of hearsay now. Does this order, if this court decides that the right framework in which to review this order is strict scrutiny, does this order survive strict scrutiny?
I think it does, Justice Kurofsky. I don't think that the petitioners have actually met that burden. I think that their briefing is filled with conclusory assertions, but the facts aren't there. Let's start with the minimum burden. We got to put things in context a little bit. When we look at Miller, the case they've talked about, and the Amish, the situation with the buggies and the state order requiring all vehicles to have a slow moving vehicle sign, there was a direct hit on their religious beliefs. For them to put that sign would have led to shunning or excommunication under their religious beliefs. We don't have any such evidence, stipulated facts in this case, that there'd be anything like shunning or excommunication. Secondly, I don't think the petitioners in this case have shown that there is actually less restrictive means. It can't possibly be the situation that a local health officer is simply left with telling schools, go ahead, social distance, spray some Lysol around, and you're good. It can't be the case that her job is simply to sit at the desk and rubber stamp the safety plans of these schools that simply say the same thing. Social distancing curtails spread. And what this order tried to do was stop the full influx of students, teachers, and staff all coming in. The petitioners have not offered this court any scientific evidence, any experts, like what we saw with the Amish in the Miller case, where they have shown that that approach was wrong and that there was some better alternative that could have met the governmental's legitimate interest in this case.
There are less restrictive means, though, of accommodating the sincerely held religious beliefs of petitioners, aren't there?
I don't believe that there. I think we have to consider what are we comparing in terms of what might be a less restrictive alternative.
Let me give you a specific example, counsel, to address. It's my understanding that churches are still allowed to have church services under this order. Is that correct?
That's correct.
So the health commissioner has allowed, and I'll use the example of Catholic Mass because that is one of the issues that petitioners have put at the forefront of their argument. Catholic Masses can still be held outside of the context of the school day. Is that correct?
That is correct.
So wouldn't a less restrictive means of accommodating the petitioners, the schools, the parents, and the students would be to allow them to have communal mass together as a school, observing appropriate social distancing and other health and safety precautions?
A communal mass on a Saturday or Sunday is a different thing than how do we protect these children, the teacher, and the community from all entering a building at the same time, commingling all day long at the same time in their classroom, in the hallways, in the cafeteria, and all leaving at the same time. Bus pickups, bus drop-offs, other parents going out into the community. A lesser alternative, a better approach, has not been offered by the petitioners, short of arguing, well, we use sanitation in our buildings, and we try to keep people socially distant. But
counsel, if the schools used exactly the same measures that the churches use on Saturdays or Sundays when they're having mass, why wouldn't that be a less restrictive means of accommodating the sincerely held religious beliefs of petitioners?
Because on Saturday or Sunday, they're attending mass, whether it may be an hour or 2 hours. We're talking about a full school day. How do you accomplish reducing COVID transmission that is airborne when people are...
I'm just talking about the mass part. Counsel, I'm just talking about the mass part of the school day. As I understand petitioners' claims, they wish to be able to have communal mass together during the school day.
And, you know, with respect to, well, if I'm understanding your question with respect to masks, Justice Bradley, we're talking about children. You know, my children can barely keep their masks on. Their natural inclination is to take the mask off, to run around, to commingle with the other children. And that's the concern for the volume of time that we're talking about, that they're all in school 5 days a week.
But this order allows the youngest of children to attend school. So wouldn't older children be better able to manage their mask wearing than the young children?
Older children, sure. You know, maybe the high school kids might do so, but then you still have the problem of they're together all day long in the same classrooms, and there's still a risk here. And
counsel, can I ask a question? The way I read that sub 8 that we talked about that allows for the religious entities and groups, if they wanted to gather just for mass, which is a purpose of religious practice, does this order prohibit the gathering for mass? Doesn't this order really affect the closing of the buildings for other purposes, not for mass?
Yeah, in that instance, they would fall within the exception, as you know.
So as Justice Rebecca Bradley is stating, this order does, in fact, allow an accommodation for the practice, the religious practice of gathering for Mass by school children. Is that correct?
That's correct. And when we look at what the U.S. Supreme Court did just 2 weeks ago in the Brooklyn case, and we look at Jacobson, and we look at the universe of federal decisions around the country, not one court plays the role of nitpicking or second guessing or trying to recalibrate what this health order ought to do. The decision itself and the per curiam decision recognize that there is some level of deference that is given. The problem in that case was the full knockout blow on the churches. It was really geared. I think the court even commented that it was basically gerrymandered and was going after them. And of course the court struck it down. But in any other situation, such as this one, involving a neutral, generally applicable, non-discriminatory health order, the petitioners can't find, nor can they cite, because none of them are out there, where any court has said, well, you should have calibrated a little bit differently. There has to be some level of deference given to the local health officers to try to resolve this situation. And I think she was doing that. The numbers in the state certainly were skyrocketing in the spring when everybody was trying to learn about this and figure out what it was. Remember, early in this pandemic, we all thought we had to clean our groceries and clean doorknobs and the like. It wasn't until the summer that we learned it's more of an airborne thing.
I don't think anybody disputes that courts must give some deference to the policy choices as long as there is a statutory authority for the particular person making these policy choices to do so. I do want to bring the conversation and the questioning back to the statutory argument, but I have to tell you, with respect to the your responses on the constitutional claims, I don't find the federal courts, or what really any courts are doing in the country, to be very persuasive, because we have a Wisconsin constitution in this state with a religious liberty clause and provisions that are much stronger than even the First Amendment. And so I think our case law is the most important for this court to consult. And the federal case law, as Justice Hagedorn mentioned, is really far less persuasive because it does not interpret our constitutional provisions. But I would like to return to the statutory argument. I think you tried to start there and we moved to the Constitution. So I wanted to ask you in particular if you can address the argument that petitioners are making with respect to our analysis vis-a-vis 252.02, which specifically gives DHS or purports to give DHS the ability to close schools to control outbreaks and epidemics. It also says that DHS can forbid public gatherings. 252.03, though, which is the source of the local health officer's authority, does not contain the may close schools language. It does contain the forbid public gatherings language. I understood part of your argument in your briefing to be that this broad language forbidding public gatherings could encompass school closures or restrictions on schools' ability to assemble in person. But we do have to give a different meaning to each of those phrases, correct?
You absolutely do have to plumb the language of the statute. And if I can just round back to that, Justice Bradley, by first commenting just for a couple few seconds on the Wisconsin Constitution. Yes, the language is broad. It expresses a real protection of religious beliefs. But the petitioners, and I think it's in their briefing, including their reply brief, say, look at Cooley, look at Yoder, and all those cases. And when you look at all those cases, you see caveats, especially in Yoder, Sherbert, and Prince, talking about the public health, safety, and welfare. And so we're only asking the court to really look at the full context of all those cases based on the situation here. And also to keep in mind that Cooley was really more of a narrow decision addressing the ministerial exception, where there's real entanglement in the government trying to basically force an employment decision in the church. Of course, that's not tolerated under the ministerial duty exception. But to go back to the the statutory arguments. We have broad language here. And as I was trying to point out, this broad language is coming from common law at the time that told local officials that they needed to do all things that were reasonable and necessary to try to curb a pandemic. It's the Burge case from 1897 that basically told the legislature, go and put this on the books. And when you look at that decision and the 1904 decisions, Jacobson in 1905, and then Lowe in 1909, collectively, all those cases are signifying that to the legislature at that time that it is permissible, if it is statutorily mandated, to do all things as reasonable and necessary to curb a communicable disease. In fact, the Burge case uses some of the same language that is in this current statute. So it's no surprise that the legislature for over 100 years has had this broad language in there. The fact that at some point in time they cobbled together another provision and allowed DHS to close schools does not speak to the broad statutory mandate that is conferred on the local health officer. The legislature has repeatedly recognized that a local health officer can close schools. It is part of the inherent power. Before this pandemic, think of all of the interplay and workings between schools and local health officers. It doesn't just take, some kind of really terrible disease like Ebola to cause a single school to shut down. She has the ability to close schools, including in a pandemic. And for the petitioners here to argue she can only close a school if we have an unsanitary condition, if we got rodents running around in the classrooms, if we've got lead or some other type of health hazards to humans, she can close schools under all those circumstances. However, she can't close it when it comes to a communicable disease. That is not a fair reading of 252.03's mandate
But is it a fair reading to interpret what is reasonable and necessary to encompass anything and everything? There have to be some limits on the local health officer's authority. And if you agree with that, what are the limits?
I agree there are limits. And we are certainly not asking for a ruling that says the health order or the health local health officer can do anything and everything she wants. Absolutely not. Think about a situation such as the annual flu. Could she close down one school or the entire school system for the common flu? No, it would not be reasonable and necessary for two reasons. Number one, there's no medical science and epidemiological data that would support such a thing. And number two, as a matter of practice and custom and history in this state, in our cold weather seasons, never ever has that happened. So we know that would not be unreasonable. So to answer your question, Justice Bradley, what are the safeguards? The safeguards are inherent in the statute itself. Her action has to be reasonable. Number two, it has to be necessary.
Counsel, while you're looking at reasonable and necessary, it's my understanding that only Dane County and perhaps part of Kenosha County is closed. The schools have had an order similar to this. And if what is done in Dane County is reasonable and necessary, why just those two places being closed when the pandemic is statewide?
Well, let me first start by saying I don't know what the current scorecard is around the state as to who's open, who's closed, what's virtual and what's not. But to answer your more general question, I think the patchwork you're seeing around the state actually reflects that this language works. It is, and we see this in the amicus briefing from all the state agencies. There is a need that the legislature has declared for the local health officer to be the boots on the ground and to work in her community as to what is best. So we see in some counties, they have pulled the reins back entirely on their local health officer and they are doing nothing. We have seen some counties where the local health officer has been terminated or has resigned because of the resistance. And then we see counties like Dane County here, where they have tried to work with the data and the science and tried to protect their community. So the fact that you have this patchwork actually shows that it's working. Every community can make its best decisions for its constituents, what needs to be done. And that's part of the safeguards within 252.03. There's two other safeguards. Number four, she has to be working on a communicable disease. That goes right back to my hypothetical of, let's say it's the common cold. Clearly that's not, you know, sure, it's a communicable disease, but not of the nature that we have in this situation. And number five, she's reporting. She has to constantly report. And that's what our local health officer does. She's reporting to DHS. They're working closely and intimately together as to what is the best for this community. She's reporting back to her governing bodies. So we don't have any of the concerns that you saw in Palm, where the electors would essentially have to wait 4 years to make any kind of changes on her conduct. In local government, she's directly accountable and supervised by the county executive, the mayor, their governing bodies, as well as the board of health that governs and supervises her.
And so I want to just look a little bit at the statutory history and see if you have any thoughts on this. So my understanding is that in 1883, the legislature gives the local health officers the power to take necessary measures to prevent, suppress, and control communicable diseases. And then in 1913, the legislature grants the State Board of Health, which it earlier created, and it grants them the power to close schools. Then in 1918, you got the flu, you have a statewide order to close schools at that point. And then in 1919, the legislature amends the statute again, and they explicitly consider giving them power to close schools. The Attorney General opines that that might be problematic the way it's worded, and they leave it out. And the 1919 amendments to the statute do not give, kind of conspicuously omit, the power to close schools to local health officers. And there's been some restructuring since then in 1923 to the form they're in today and a few other amendments since then. But when I look at that history, it sure seems to me that the way this has been designed, that the legislature did not think that locals had the power to close schools and that they explicitly gave it to DHS and not to the local health officers. I wondered if you have any comment or response to that.
Well, I don't believe that any of the parties in this case are aware of the Attorney General opinion you just cited, and I'd be curious to see what is the analysis there. Were schools considered something at the time to be only statewide, or were they considered something more local or not? I'd also be interested to see whether or not between the AG and the legislature, they felt that this language was already broad enough for her to act such that it didn't need any further tweaking.
But just to answer that, the Attorney General opinion basically, whether right or wrong, basically said the power as worded gave too much discretion to the local health officer, and it would be unconstitutional, as I recall. And so the legislature then, there was some consideration of tweaking the language to put more controls on it by making it necessary, but adding a necessary language, but that wasn't included in the statute, so.
But I think we'd have to also look at the legislative history all the way up through 1982, where the legislature goes back in and removes the condition that the local health officer needs to get approval more directly from her board and gave her more robust authority. And so I think we'd have to look at it all collectively. And I think we would still come back and arrive at the same conclusion that this language is broad, but it is cabined. And it would allow her to close schools. But also keep in mind here, she did not close schools. There was not a full closure of the school system. This was a phasing in, and she was trying to track what the numbers were doing. She was seeing a suppression in the numbers, and she wanted to put her foot down and try to suppress this COVID-19. And I think that the approach that she was taking was permissible both under the statute and even the case law. There's substantial room, as many jurists around the country have found, to try to draw appropriate lines to knock this thing out. And I think that's what she was trying to do. And certainly, I think if it had continued, maybe at least in Dane County, the numbers would be a little bit more tolerable than what we're seeing right now. The petitioners in this case have also pointed to language in 252.03 about her ability to only inspect the schools, but I'd like this court to to recognize that when you look at that clause in 252.03 sub 1, it is the last sentence. It comes after her broader power, the mandate to do what is reasonable and necessary to prevent, suppress, and control a communicable disease. That language is also tied very specifically to the attention that, or to the point that she is to inspect, quote, as needed to determine whether the buildings are kept in sanitary condition, close quote. So that's very narrow language. It's certainly not applicable here. I think that the petitioners are not even faithfully following their own rules of statutory interpretation when we look at the language and whether something is specific, whether certain magic words are in there or not. And
also, I'd like to explore that a little further with you, because the way I understand your argument, basically it would read out a lot of the language in 252.03, because all that would need to be in there would be that local health officers may do what is reasonable and necessary for the prevention and suppression of disease. So as I understand your argument, we would read out the language may forbid public gatherings because that would fall under reasonable and necessary. It would read out the local health officer's ability to inspect schools and public buildings within his or her jurisdiction, because that too would fall under what is reasonable and necessary for the prevention and suppression of disease. So as I'm trying to faithfully apply the canons of statutory construction as expressed in our cases, tell me how your argument does not read out all of that more specific language in favor of the very broad and general may do what is reasonable and necessary language.
Justice Bradley, it doesn't read out that language because those subjects of inspection or forbidding public gathering are simply illustrations of her power. There is nothing within 252.03 that lists every type of measure and everything she can possibly do, because no legislature, nobody would know what communicable disease you might get once every 100 years and what steps you have to take. And just like this court did in City of Milwaukee versus Washington, where the court said that the situation involving someone with tuberculosis and whether they could be safely confined in jail, the language at issue in 252 did not specifically authorize that. And this court said, nor does it preclude that. And we look at the language broad enough to fulfill its purpose. Here, we clearly have language that allows this local health officer to attempt to phase in the schooling of all these children, all these teachers, all these staff, bit by bit to try to keep control and suppression of the pandemic. The petitioners have also pointed to the fact that that this COVID-19 does raise, in fact, a compelling governmental interest. And I think that that's a point that shouldn't be lost, including when we're looking at whether she acted reasonably and necessary under the statute or in terms of the constitutional analysis. I think it's very difficult to unwind that admission that she is acting and this health order is trying to accomplish a compelling governmental interest and then come to the conclusion that somehow that it was unreasonable and unnecessary. The last couple points I'd like to make is that when she issued this order in August of this past year, just 30 days before that, Justice Kavanaugh issued a decision in Calvary where his concurring opinion remarked how there is such substantial room to draw these lines. And that courts should be very deferential to the states when they're engaging in line drawing. And at least under the federal constitution, he felt that state and local governments have the primary responsibility to address COVID-19, whether it's quarantine requirements, testing plans, mask mandates, phased reopenings, or he said school closures. Again, here we don't have a school closure, but she's certainly trying to calibrate what she is seeing in the data and trying to phase people in into the school, trying to allow them to have some schooling, trying to protect the community as best as she could. With that, Your Honors, my clients would respectfully request that this court vacate its injunction and find that this original action should not have been granted and dismiss this action. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you very much. Attorney Essenberg, are you prepared to begin rebuttal? You're still muted. Your mic is not turned on. Okay, good. Now you can begin.
Thank you for pointing that out. I'd like to return to my friend Mr. Bitar's statement that at some point the legislature cobbled something together had more specific limitations and authorizations with respect to the power of these two entities, as if that's something that can be waived away. I think that's wrong. And I think, as Justice Hagedorn pointed out, this was an attempt to address a problem that would otherwise occur. The same type of problem, I think, that the Chief Justice's opinion identified in Palm, that we cannot read this general directive to do whatever is necessary as an unrestricted grant of police power. And I think the legislature quite clearly made a determination here that when we are going to take the type of extraordinary steps that were taken here, as reasonable as they may be, as necessary as they may be, we don't need to get to that because we're not talking about whether what was done here is a good idea. We're talking about whether it was a legally authorized and done in the correct way. But when these extraordinary steps are taken, they have to be authorized by the Department of Health Services. And I think that that is clearly established by the conspicuous absence of authorization on the part of local health officials to close schools. The suggestion, I think, that they are not closing schools seems to me to be not strict construction, but with due respect, a wildly cramped construction to say that when the legislature passed this law in many years ago, that it meant and decided that it would not grant local health officials the power to close schools, that it somehow meant that although they couldn't close the physical building, that it would be okay if they kept the school open as in modern terms, a virtual school, or to use an older term, a correspondence school. I mean, that is simply inconsistent with our common understanding of the statutory language. It's inconsistent with its original meaning. And as Mr. Sutlin points out, it's inconsistent with the stipulation in this case and with terminology that the parties frequently use, further suggesting its common sense and plain meaning understanding of the statute is that these schools are closed in this instance.
Mr. Essen, let me ask you a question. Do you, under your reading of the statute, believe that the DHS secretary could close an individual school?
I think that the DHS secretary could close an individual school.
Okay. And could the DHS secretary close a district?
I think the DHS secretary could close some subset other than all the schools in the state of Wisconsin, although any such closure order would have to be subject to other constitutional considerations, such as the ones that our clients have raised with respect, for example, religious exercise.
So a DHS secretary under your reading of the statute could close an individual school, could close, Madison could close all the Madison schools, or could close a countywide. You agree that individual, citywide, countywide?
In theory, yes. I you'd want to look at exactly what was done and why it was done, but yes, I think theoretically that's true.
Or close all the schools in the state?
DHS secretary could close all the schools in the state, again, subject to other constitutional limitations.
Thank you.
In conclusion, I wanted to point out that there's a distinction here between the religious claims that our clients have advanced and the statutory claims that they have advanced. With respect to these religious claims and the burden that our clients claim is effectuated on their religious practice, it is not incumbent upon the plaintiffs to prove, or the petitioners to prove, that their sincerely held religious belief is religiously true. That is, the court does not have the authority to evaluate that and determine whether or not a half a loaf or attending mass on Saturday would be enough. It must accept that and apply strict scrutiny.
Thank you. Thank you, counsel. Attorney, will you tell me how to properly say your name? I'm always embarrassed that I don't think I say it quite right. I say Sethlin, yes, no.
Sethlin.
Say it again.
Sethlin.
Sethlin.
There we go.
Okay, thank you very much. Thank you. Now you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. Just a couple of points on the religious exercise conscious clause argument. The reason that my friend relies over and over on Smith and the phrase that he repeatedly uses, general neutral law of general applicability, is because they cannot prevail under this court's test in Miller and Cooley. And my friend said a couple of times that this court has never opined on Smith, hasn't determined whether Smith applies. I would ask your honors to look at 67 through 69 at Miller. This court specifically considered whether to adopt Justice Scalia's approach from Smith or whether to retain this court's strict scrutiny approach. This court in Miller unanimously determined to reject Smith, not distinguish Smith, explicitly reject Smith in favor of the strict scrutiny approach under Sherbert, and then that approach was carried over under Cooley. Next, my friend used the phrase a couple of times that this order was not a knockout blow on religion. Well, that's with respect, not the test. The test proceeds in two steps, and each step has two parts. First, we have the burden of showing a sincere religious belief that is burdened. I think it is very clear from the statements of undisputed fact that we have established that. Then the burden shifts to them to prove that they satisfy strict scrutiny. That burden is not on us. That burden is on them. So your honors would have to look at the four corners of the statement of undisputed fact to determine whether they've carried that burden. And with respect, they haven't come close. My friend here disparaged our reopening plans. We enacted those and created those reopening plans in careful consultation with his client under the provisions that are still in the executive order here. If your honors look at JA 6 through 7, the comprehensive rules that we need to have a safe reopening are right there. And they were right there until late on a Friday evening, the Monday before we were set to reopen, and some of us had already reopened, we're going. Nothing had changed with COVID between when they created those rules and when there was a closure. Clearly, allowing us to reopen using those plans that were complete compliance with the respondents' own rules is a less restrictive means.
Mr. Sethlin, I want to ask you a question about the final submission that you had in this case, and it had to do with the Cuomo case from the U.S. Supreme Court. And I'm looking from your letter that was submitted to us on December 3rd, and you quote from that case, and it says that, thus these regulations treated houses of worship much more harshly than comparable secular facilities. And they're quoting another case. You're quoting what was in the Cuomo case, and they're quoting another case. And I want to understand if your argument is that houses of worship or I think the what we're talking about in this school are religious schools, how those are being treated more harshly than secular schools are.
We are not at all arguing that, Your Honor. The point of that, the diocese case is that to the extent my friend relied repeatedly on Jacobson and the Chief Justice's separate opinion in South Bay, the diocese case makes clear that Jacobson has no relevance in this context when it comes to enumerated constitutional rights, and the Chief Justice's opinion has no relevance whatsoever. It was a separate opinion that the Supreme Court did not. And after that, Your Honor could put aside the diocese case, could put aside Jacobson, could put aside South Bay, and apply Miller and Cooley. And that's where I would really like to leave it. I understand that Your Honors have strong disagreements among each other about the meaning of the particular statute and here and the statutory arguments. But this court's decision in Miller was unanimous. It unanimously rejected Smith for a different standard. So whatever Your Honors do on the statutory argument, I would urge Your Honors to consider whether a fair, neutral application of the two steps in Miller really should lead to, hopefully, a unanimous decision from this court that this statute is subject to strict scrutiny under Miller, even though it wouldn't be under Smith, because Miller is the governing rule here, and that they have not carried their heavy burden under strict scrutiny. That kind of powerful statement from this court, consistent with what this court did in Miller, would be beneficial to all the people of the state. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you. And thank you all for excellent oral arguments and for fine briefs. These are very, very important questions that are raised, whether you're looking at it purely statutorily or whether you look at it through the constitutional lens. So we very much appreciate all of your efforts, both briefing and before us this morning. The court will adjourn now and meet in closed conference at 2:00 this afternoon.
Madam Chief Justice?
Yes.
May I add one point in response to what the last question from Justice Karofsky?
Oh, I think not, counsel, but thank you for the offer. We are adjourned.